Welcome to a special bonus episode of Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North and I'd like to take you back in time, but not too far, just a little over 10 years. The 14th of May 2009 marked the launch of the Herschel Space Observatory. Herschel was a cornerstone mission for ESA, the European Space Agency, with the goal of unveiling the hidden universe. In this programme we'll find out how it did this and what astronomers have uncovered. Such missions take a lot of planning, and Herschel was decades in the making, with an international team of at least hundreds of people. But such missions also far outlive the operational lifetime of the spacecraft itself. Herschel's liquid helium coolant ran out on the 29th of April 2013, after just under 4 years in space, and the spacecraft was switched off shortly afterwards. With 25,000 observations in the bag, though, and having imaged around 10% of the sky, scientific discoveries are still being made with the data from Herschel. But what have we learnt from the mission, and what is there still to learn from Herschel? We've had a lot of involvement here in Cardiff University, from the design and build of the scientific instruments to the analysis of its data. What better people to ask than those who helped run the mission and who are using its data to continue to make scientific discoveries a decade on from its launch?
Well, we've learned a great deal about the universe, both near and far. In our own solar system, for example, we've learned a lot more about the small solid bodies, the asteroids, and the similar objects orbiting further out from the Sun in what's called the Kuiper Belt. This is debris left over from the formation of the solar system, so it's telling us about how our solar system works today and giving us some clues as to how it formed in the past. In our own galaxy, we've learned a huge amount about how stars form from clouds of gas and dust in space. And further out, we've learned when looking at distant galaxies, how they form and evolve. So it's given us a new perspective on the whole universe. So that's one of the great powers of Herschel, its versatility. And because it was exploring a new part of the electromagnetic spectrum, it had something to say in all areas of astrophysics.
That was Professor Matt Griffin, who led the international team behind SPIRE, one of three scientific instruments on board Herschel. I asked Matt what advantage Herschel had over other telescopes and observatories.
Herschel was working in a part of the spectrum, the far infrared and submillimeter, that was largely unexplored because it's impossible to observe at those wavelengths from the ground or even from an aircraft. So getting into space was essential. And when one launches a spacecraft, there are some restrictions. For instance, we can't build telescopes that are as big as the ones we can build on the ground. But once in space, it's possible to make a telescope very cold. And one of the properties of infrared radiation is that it's emitted by hot objects. So we were able to make the telescope nice and cold to avoid swamping the signals from the astronomical source by the emission of the telescope itself. And we were able to equip it with instruments that were able to take images and take spectra to analyze the light, breaking it up into its constituent colors to make the kind of observations that astronomers wanted. From space and getting above the atmosphere, it was a huge advantage, not only in terms of the access to certain parts of the spectrum that were blocked, but also as anybody involved in astronomy, either as a professional or as an amateur, knows, the Earth's atmosphere is often a terrible inconvenience.
Yes, quite. Now, Herschel had three scientific instruments on board, and you were leading one of them with a part of a big international collaboration. That was the SPIRE instrument, and there was also PAX and HiFi. Now, they're acronyms, that what they mean doesn't really matter, but why three instruments and not just, you know, one big instrument?
Well, Herschel needed to do different kinds of observations, and the different kinds of observations require different technologies and different kinds of detectors. It's also a wise thing to do with any spacecraft to have more than one instrument. Putting all your eggs in one basket could be unfortunate if there's a little mishap. So there were three instruments on board Herschel. It would have been very unfortunate if any of them had gone wrong, but then at least there would have been two others still functioning. As it happened, all three instruments on Herschel worked extremely well.
It was a close call, though, early on, right?
There was one of the instruments, Hi-Fi, suffered a problem, an anomaly, that put it out of operation for nearly 6 months. That was 6 months of very intensive investigation to see if the instrument could be safely switched on again, to make sure the problem was properly understood and that the workaround that they had for it would work well. Luckily, it turned out to be okay, because as in many instruments, there were what are called redundant systems. In other words, for any important function, one builds the capability of doing it with a backup system in case the primary system goes wrong in any way, and that actually worked. So that was the one major anomaly, and luckily it was sorted out. So all three instruments worked very well, but they had really to be built and designed separately, because they were carrying out different kinds of observations with different kinds of detectors and technology.
You mentioned learning about the solar system and the objects in the solar system. What do we learn from looking at these in the infrared or far infrared that we don't from optical telescopes?
Well, for instance, when we look at, say, an asteroid in the optical, what we see is reflected sunlight, and that can tell us a great deal about the object. But at longer wavelengths in the infrared, what we see is the radiation that's actually emitted by the asteroid itself. And that tells us a different story. That tells us something else about the surface of the asteroid. And some of them are so far away that we cannot tell accurately what sizes they have. But there's a technique that's quite reliable in the infrared, that by studying the infrared radiation, we can infer the size and the temperature and the surface properties in a way that we can't do in the optical. So it's another example of one of the themes of Herschel, which is that if you combine the observations made at shorter wavelengths, say using optical telescopes from the ground, and the observations made at longer wavelengths using Herschel, then you get the full picture, as it were. Either one alone, it only tells you half the story.
Now, Herschel's instruments didn't just take pictures. They could also provide the chemical fingerprint of what they're looking at.
If one looks at a typical Herschel picture, that gives you the basic physical structure of an object, whether it be a galaxy or a star-forming cloud or whatever. If one takes a spectrum, then one can see the telltale signatures of particular atoms and molecules which like to absorb or emit light at certain wavelengths. And with data like that, you can tell a huge amount, for instance, just by detecting that certain wavelengths or frequencies are there in the spectrum, you know the chemical composition. And by looking in detail at the strength of the features, you can tell how much of the material is there. You can also tell what temperature it's at, what pressure it's at, what density it has, and so on. And so build up a picture, not only of the chemistry, but also the physical makeup of the object. And all of that allows us to figure out how it's behaving, how it's evolving, and get the full picture of its physical state. An example of that, for instance, is, say, the atmospheres of the giant planets. So Herschel was able to look at the spectral features emitted and absorbed in the atmospheres of giant planets, and to determine all kinds of properties about the chemistry and the physics and the temperature and pressure in those atmospheres. And that has a great bearing on our own meteorology. We know a lot about the structure of the Earth's atmosphere, how it behaves, but in order to get a general picture, we need to compare the Earth's atmosphere to those on other planets.
One of the things that Herschel predominantly observed was cosmic dust. But what do we actually mean by dust in this context? The nature and origin of dust is something that Professor Haley Gomez has been studying using Herschel observations. The first question to ask is, what is the dust and why do astronomers care so much about it?
It's the name that we give tiny solid particles, mostly made up of carbon and silicon, sometimes iron, sometimes gems. And these particles float between stars, they collect together to form planets like the Earth, they collect together to form life itself. So it's the solid, raw material that is often very, very small, actually, only about the width of a human hair, or we like to think of it as a smoke particle.
So that kind of size.
Yeah, the size of a smoke particle. So it's tiny, tiny, tiny solid lumps of rock, But of course, bigger versions of them become asteroids, comets, core comets, and rocky planets, potentially. So it's kind of like the rawest material.
Well, that analogy with smoke is useful because when you look into a smoky room or past a bonfire or something with smoke coming out, it really highlights how opaque the smoke is. And that's one of the problems with the observing these things in the optical, if you like, in optical wavelengths, that the smoke, the dust, the cosmic dust, is blocks everything out.
Yeah, it's exactly like a giant smoke screen across galaxies. And across the entire universe, we have so much dust in our own galaxy, it's difficult to see out sometimes. And other galaxies are so full of dust, you can't see the stars inside them. Same thing for searching for star formation sites and planets formation. There's just so much dust in the way. And I definitely think a smokescreen is the best way to think of it. And, you know, it's tiny grains. It's only 0.1% of the mass of a galaxy. So we're talking insignificant masses and size, at least compared to astronomical standards normally. But yeah, it can block up to 90% of the light from an entire galaxy. So it really profoundly changes the way we view the universe.
So what do we learn when we look at this new view of the universe? What have we learned, for example, about the way stars form and evolve? That's something that Dr. Sarah Reagan is investigating.
First and foremost, the context of star formation is so much better understood now. And this is thanks to the survey of the entire galactic plane in the far infrared. And what the galactic plane survey did was give us a full census of all the structures involved in star formation, from the web of molecular cloud structures down to the individual protostars that until now had been obscured by dust to us. Herschel also studied the evolution of water in star-forming regions and tried to pin down at what point it becomes important in the development and evolution of young stars.
And so when we look at Herschel's images and we look at all these different scales, what kind of scales are we talking about? We have our sun and its solar system of planets and so on, and the nearest stars are a few light years away typically. The galaxy itself is 100,000 light years across or thereabouts. So that's a huge range in scales. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about star formation in the galaxy, what kind of range of scales are we looking at with Herschel?
We're essentially probing all of those scales. We had the galactic plane survey, which enabled us to view the galaxy as a whole. And that has really not been done in this level of detail before. We're also looking at individual star systems and looking at what the environment is like for the disk that forms around a young star, how that evolves, and what the chemistry is in those regions. So right down to solar system scales.
So let's try and describe a star forming region. So we have this cloud of dust, and it forms these, or it normally forms these filaments, these like long tubular structures. And we're trying to get an idea of how they form. That's something we're still trying to figure out, as far as I understand.
Indeed, it's been a long-standing problem in astrophysics, actually. The formation of filaments is actually a natural consequence of just a normal gravitationally bound cloud of gas and dust. But what Herschel enabled us to do is to really characterize the physical properties of those filaments, and that really helps us constrain those models much, much better.
So that's the temperature, the density, all those things.
Precisely, yes. We knew about these structures before, but mainly because we were working with either optical data or near-infrared data, most of this dust appears as a silhouette, and there's only so much you can get about from a shadow, right?
Yeah.
And now, with the information from the far infrared that Herschel provided, we now know what those physical structures are like and what how they might evolve and, you know, what their lifetimes might be.
So, you say we get an idea of the lifetime. We don't watch these things evolve. They take much longer than, well, certainly, Herschel's lifetime was 4 years. They take longer than that. They take much longer than a human
Millions
lifetime
years,
to
yes.
Years. So how do we go from snapshots to knowing how long these things take?
That's a very good question. We have to make a lot of leaps of faith in that game. Generally what we do is we have a bit of an idea of a loose picture in our mind, and we try to do a census of all the objects in the region and classify them in some sort of category according to age.
So old ones, young ones.
Old ones, young ones, those in between. And we have different signposts for all those different stages. And if you have loads of objects in the very earliest stage and not quite as many in the later stage, then you can sort of infer that the lifetime of that very earliest stage is a lot longer because you assume that you're getting kind of a fair census of the entire system. You know, we really had no idea what the lifetime of that youngest, earliest stage is until Herschel.
Okay. And so how long are we talking here? 100,000, millions of years?
More like millions of years, yeah.
Okay, so this is a slow process.
A slow process, but in astrophysical terms, that's quite quick.
Okay, and so when you've got this filament and it has, so you've got this long tube-like structure of gas and dust, and Herschel sees the dust, but the gas is the main component of what forms stars, right? We just don't really see that easily with Herschel, is that right?
That's absolutely correct, yes. We have to assume, and we're generally quite confident, that the gas and dust are pretty evenly mixed throughout the interstellar medium. So, but at the conditions of star-forming regions, the gas isn't very helpful, and it doesn't give us a lot to work with. So the dust is of absolutely vital probe for the structure of these regions.
And so how big are these filaments? How wide? How long?
There's a huge range of things. In individual star-forming regions, the filaments can be a few parsecs in size, so maybe tens of light years in general. However,
How long they are.
That's how long they are. But across, I suppose, they would be maybe even a fraction of a light year.
Okay, so they're very long and
they're very long and spindly, yes.
Yeah. Studying our own galaxy is useful for understanding star formation in the universe today. But what about in the past? Dr. Mattia Negrello looks much further afield at distant galaxies, so far away they were seen as they were billions of years ago, sometimes not long after the Big Bang itself. What does this tell us about the history of the universe?
Well, what we have learned from Herschel is that most of the star formation activity in the universe happened about 10 billion years ago. We had some indication of that before the launch of Herschel, but Herschel really helped us to pinpoint this key period in the evolution of the universe. And when you have a galaxy that is forming a huge amount of stars, one thing you have to deal with is the dust obscuration, because this intensively star-forming regions, they tend to be obscured by dust.
So it blocks out the image from optical telescopes, normal telescopes.
Exactly. So some of the galaxies, for example, that Herschel managed to detect, they are not detected but even in the deepest HST images. And so you would have been completely missed them even with a superb instrument like the HST.
That's the Hubble Space Telescope.
The Hubble Space Telescope. And so Herschel gave us this complementary view in a region of the electromagnetic spectrum to which the Hubble Space Telescope is blind. And that helped us to better understand how the galaxies we see today in the universe were built, about 10 billion years ago.
All this still leaves one big question. Where did all this dust come from? This is one of Halley's big research areas.
The idea is it's basically like snowflake formation. Okay, so you've got gas at the right temperatures and densities that the solid grains can condense out of the material, in the same way snowflakes condense out of our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So you just need the right temperatures and conditions. They don't tend to happen unless you've got something like star death. Okay, so death of a star like our CERN in a planetary nebula, you have stellar winds, nice, gentle, full of heavy elements, kind of dense, cool.
So not, the right not conditions, too hot, not too cold.
Not too hot, not too cold, exactly. You need the perfect conditions for this to happen. And the funny thing is, in an exploding star, you don't think you're going to get the right conditions.
It's sounds very pretty hot.
Yeah, it's really hot. It's very explosive. It's very violent. You know, you've got 10,000 degree gas, and you're talking about solid particles surviving when they should just be vaporized. But consistently, every time we look at these supernova remnants, we call them, the aftermath of the explosion, you see a huge amount of hot gas. And right where you see the hot gas, you see these cool, minus 250 degree dust grains, solid particles that are just there, and they're sitting in this hot gas and they're surviving. That's a big surprise. No one really understands why that happens. There must be something to do with the clumpiness or density of the gas that allows these dust grains to kind of shield themselves from the hot gas around them.
So they're sort of insulating themselves against the heat outside.
That's right, yeah. So and we see cold molecules too. Huge surprise. CO, carbon monoxide, silicon monoxide, things that you just don't expect to see that are minus 250 degrees or 20 degrees Kelvin. You just expect them to be much hotter because they're sat in this hot gas. So something's happening in the evolution of these systems that we don't understand. We can make it work, but it's a surprise that we have to make it work.
So how do we know that in these explosions that stuff was created, and how do we know it wasn't just there beforehand?
Oh, yeah, that's a really, really good question. And actually, if you look at, which we've done, if you look at the 200 or so supernovae that have happened in our own galaxy that we know about, and you look at the Herschel maps of those supernovae, there's only about 30 that you can actually say it's related to a supernova and is not just swept up material or potentially material dust along the line of sight towards
between us and the
supernova. You know, some of these supernovae are behind spiral arms and there's a lot of dust in the spiral arm. So one thing you have to do is you have to compare it with what you know the supernova properties are or what the supernova looks like in, for example, radio waves, or the hot gas shines in X-rays, so we have X-ray images, and we look for Herschel dust structures in the Herschel images that match up with those. It's a lot of kind of looking for things, but by eye is the only way you can do it, actually. You need to have someone looking at these maps and saying that is definitely related to the supernova. Sometimes it's really obvious because it's right smack bang in the middle of where the star was, and it's there and nothing else is around it. But most of the time it's messy.
Yeah. We also want to catch these things early. And I guess the earliest we can think about catching them is one particular supernova from the late 1980s. So it's now 30 years old. Herschel was observing it a few years ago. That's pretty young in a supernova lifetime, supernova remnant lifetime. What have we learned from those earliest stages of a supernova?
Those observations are so exciting because they, particularly of supernova 1987A, that supernova has shown us that not only do you form dust within 30 years of the supernova exploding, you know, you're talking about a process that is really quick. This is telling us that if you have your star in the early universe just after the Big Bang, it takes 10 million years to blow up, and then 30 years later you have the raw materials for planets, potentially life itself. But it's also the fact that we know that dust couldn't have been there when it blew up within the first few years, because we have observations, not with Herschel, but with Hubble, where we would have seen the effect of dust. We would have seen the dust like a dust lane or a smoke screen.
Blocking out the
visible light. And we know that didn't happen. So it wasn't there in the first few years. It wasn't there maybe even in the first 5 years, but we know it was there 30 years later when we observe it with Herschel. So some point then, the dust has been created. Somehow the conditions were just right at that time scale. But the wonderful thing is that now we've got the Herschel observations, we can monitor this supernova with other observatories, which can see the dust, and we can actually look at how that changes the time. Okay, so we don't have the time between 5 and 30 years, but we have the time from 30 years to say, you know, the next, well, in our lifetime anyway, the next few decades. So you can ask, well, does the dust continue to grow? Does it change somehow? Does it get cooler or hotter? Does it somehow get vaporized? We literally don't know what will happen to that dust. Will it survive over time? Or will it ultimately get reheated and just turn back to gas, and in the end, actually, there's nothing contributed to the universe in that case. We don't know, but we will be able to watch it, which is really cool.
You're listening to a special bonus edition of Pythagorean Astronomy, marking 10 years since the launch of the Herschel Space Observatory. We've learned that Herschel provided astronomers with a new view on the universe, revealing a vibrant network of filamentary structures made of gas and dust. We've also heard how much of that dust formed billions of years ago by looking at the properties of distant galaxies. So how about finding out more about these ancient cosmic dust factories? Such distant objects are incredibly faint, but Herschel surprised us there as well.
Some people were staggered by the quality of the images and the quality of the data that Herschel produced. In the absence of the atmosphere, one can observe with appropriate detectors and instrumentation and get a level of stability and quality of the data that really outstrips anything that can be achieved, even in the best conditions, from the ground. One of the things that allowed Herschel to do was, very importantly, since this was an unexplored part of the spectrum, was to map, to survey very large areas of the sky to detect the large-scale structure in our own galaxy and to detect many thousands of external galaxies and then to analyze their properties statistically. So the clarity that one gets when one goes above the atmosphere and the stability that one gets, these were key to the success of Herschel.
One important advantage of Herschel compared to previous instrument and the space telescope is the coverage of the sky. So before the launch of Herschel, we had some information about the existence of this highly star-forming dust-obscure galaxies, but in samples of just a few hundred. With Herschel, we managed to increase that number by 1,000. So Herschel managed to deliver us samples of hundreds of thousands of these galaxies because it could observe more than 1,000 square degrees of the sky. Just to give you an idea, if you put together all the surveys done by previous instruments that observed a similar wavelength, if you put them together, the area of the sky they cover at sublimeter wavelengths, you don't even cover an area comparable to the size of the full moon. While instead with Herschel, we cover an area that corresponds to more than 5,000 times the area of the full moon. And that means many more galaxies of this kind we can work with and play with. So this is the important legacy of Herschel. And now we have this gold mine we can go through and study in detail all these individual galaxies to understand how they formed and evolved.
And I guess the important thing here is that when you're looking at these distant galaxies, looking at one, well, in most cases, looking at one individual galaxy isn't necessarily that interesting. Well, there are some unique cases, but yeah, we might touch on. But actually, it's the ensemble, it's the collection of hundreds of thousands of galaxies, which is useful. Because it's a statistics game, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we really want to understand about these galaxies is what triggered that intense star formation activity, because these galaxies that Herschel detected, they form star at a tremendous rate of the order of 100 up to 1,000 of solar masses per year. So these galaxies can form a star like our own sun every few hours. By comparison, our own galaxy has an estimated star formation activity of the order of one solar mass per year.
So one star like our sun... Per year.
While instead in these galaxies, you can form several stars like the sun in just a few hours. And we want to understand what is actually triggering that. And in order to do that, you need to have a larger statistical sample that you can study in detail. Because as you said, you can have cases where of individual galaxies that show different kind of mechanism. But we want to understand what is the one that in general drives intense star formation activity in these galaxies. And so Herschel provides us with this large sample that we can work with and already gave some indications of what should be, is probably the main driver of the star formation activity in these galaxies, simply based on a statistical analysis of, for example, of the number of these galaxies that you can see in the sky. It's such a simple statistic, but it's very powerful in telling you how this galaxy formed, because different mechanisms, they make a different prediction about the abundance of this object in the sky. So simply by counting them, you can get some information. And so Herschel gave us some indication of the fact that probably what drives the intense star formation in these galaxies is not the smashing of two different galaxies together, which is something we see in the present-day universe and can produce this intense star formation activity, but is mainly related to the fact that these galaxies in the past, they were much more gas-rich compared to the galaxies today. So a huge amount of gas that doesn't necessarily mean the smashing of two different galaxies to be forced to collapse and form stars, but can naturally give rise to fragmentation and collapse in this very dense environment.
And that's just because stars form from clouds of gas and, exactly. and dust, but mostly gas. And just having more of that gas means more stars can be formed, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. It's as simple as that. Yeah. So.
Okay. Now, you said that it's a statistics game, that you want lots and lots of these galaxies, but there are some unique cases which are quite useful and very enlightening in their own right. And this is where we can see galaxies that are really, really distant, further than we should realistically be able to see them, through sort of chance alignments with nearby objects. So this is something called gravitational lensing. And that's something you were involved with the initial study. So how did that go? How did you find those special galaxies, those special cases?
Yeah, so the advantage of having this large area coverage, doesn't apply just to Herschel, but in general to any instrument observing the sky. When you have a large area of the sky that you are imaging, it means that you can... you have a high probability of finding very rare objects, okay?
So if you've got something that happens 1 in 1,000 times,
exactly,
then with 100,000 galaxies, you should find
100. You're more likely to find them, of course. And among these rare objects, you can find either intrinsically very extreme objects, because Herschel managed to pick up also objects that were already very, very dust-rich and forming stars at tremendous rate, less than 1 billion years after the Big Bang. And in fact, that left a big open question mark at how is it possible to have already at that time all this amount of dust, and at the same time, these galaxies also host a supermassive black hole. How can you put together a supermassive black hole of 1 billion solar masses, 1 billion years, less than 1 billion years after the Big Bang? But also you can look for this chance alignment, so you can see cases where a very distant dust-obscure galaxies is located behind another galaxy along the line of sight, okay, but closer to us. And what happened, of course, being a chance alignment is not very likely to happen. But
it's one of these rare events.
Exactly, as we said before, once you have hundreds of thousands of objects to go through, you can actually find these rare events. And what happened in that case is that the galaxy in front of the background one, because of its intense gravitational field, can distort the light coming from the distant galaxy. And this distortion gives rise to particular features in the sky, like arcs and rings, that are the typical feature of what we call the gravitational lens, which is all has to do with the bending of the rays of light as predicted by the theory of general relativity. And these are very fascinating phenomena, per se, but as a cosmologist and an extragalactic astronomer, I'm interested in finding them, because when these events occur, you get a magnified view of the distant universe and the distant galaxies. And because of that, you can study in more detail and more easily the small-scale properties of these galaxies, which is also what helps you to disentangle the different scenario for the formation of these galaxies.
So now we have this dust formed by exploding stars a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And we know it's collected into long, thin, spaghetti-like structures called filaments. But how do we go from these filaments to actual stars? Fingers crossed Sarah can shed some light.
That's a very good question, and one that I don't think there's necessarily an answer for yet. And that is very much the crux of a lot of the studies going on now. What our modeling has shown us and what some of the theory shows is that when gravity brings material together and naturally forms these filaments, if there are any sort of fluctuations or sort of imperfections or jumps in density, if you want, those tend to start a runaway process. And the sites of those places where there's just a little denser here or there are where gravity will then kind of bring more and more material there, and so it sort of sets off the domino effect, and stars begin to condense out of those sorts of filaments.
So you have a clump of then denser gas and dust. Mm-hmm. That's still not a star. That's still a cloud of gas and dust. So how do we go from there to a star? Again, I guess this is something we're still
trying to figure out?
This is something we're still trying to figure out, very much so. What we've been able to do with Herschel is really get to the bottom of some of the lifetimes that of these very early stages in star formation. And that's one of the most important problems that we've overcome, thanks to Herschel. And the problem was is that we were measuring the brightness of these forming protostars. And for a long time, we were really stuck because they weren't really as bright as we expected them to be, based on the limited number of observations we had before. And then with Herschel, since we were able to peer through that dust, that obscuring dust, we then had a really much better idea of the earlier stages. And with that census, we got a better model of the lifetime of those young stars.
So, you say we get an idea of the lifetime. We don't watch these things evolve. They take much longer than, Herschel's lifetime was 4 years. They take longer than that. They take much longer than a human lifetime. So how do we go from snapshots to knowing how long these things take?
That's a very good question. We have to make a lot of leaps of faith in that game. Generally what we do is we have a bit of an idea of a loose picture in our mind, and we try to do a census of all the objects in the region and classify them in some sort of category according to age.
So old ones, young ones.
Old ones, young ones, those in between. And we have different signposts for all those different stages. And if you have loads of objects in the very earliest stage and not quite as many in the later stage, then you can sort of infer that the lifetime of that very earliest stage is a lot longer, because you assume that you're getting kind of a fair census of the entire system. You know, we really had no idea what the lifetime of that youngest, earliest stage is until Herschel.
Okay, and so how long are we talking here? 100,000, millions of years?
More like millions of years, yeah.
Okay, so this is a slow process.
Well, a slow process, but in astrophysical terms, that's quite quick.
Okay, yeah. What this means now, of course, is that we can have observations of nearby galaxies, we can have observations of our galactic plane, we've got observations of star formations, and we've got the observations of the protostars. That has extended that range of understanding.
Right. I mean, if for the first time, really, we're able to link from the protostar all the way up to the galaxy as a whole. And we understand those, how they're linked together, much better now. And that way, if we can use the Milky Way as sort of a local laboratory, if you want, if we can understand how a protostar is linked to a star formation region, is linked to the galaxy as a whole, then we can view nearby galaxies in a similar way and understand it in terms of the building blocks that the Milky Way has sort of uncovered for us.
And I guess that's useful because there's always a worry that our galaxy is special or different in some way, not for any sort of anthropological reason, but just because, you know, all galaxies are different. But if we can look at lots of other galaxies and we've got that context for what they're then like, that's useful because we can extrapolate to these other galaxies and get a sample of 20 galaxies or 100 galaxies or 1,000 galaxies.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a question I'm personally very interested in, is what is the fundamental unit of star formation? To understand that, you want to look at the Milky Way in the context of other galaxies. How are they the same? How are they different? Both the similarities and the differences really help you get to the bottom of what is the commonality and what is the ultimate kind of controlling factor or factors in governing star formation. If you find differences in how stars form in the Milky Way compared to Andromeda, for example, then perhaps there is something fundamentally, then you can perhaps identify how galactic structure or the properties of one galaxy compared to another sort of control what's happening on small scales. And also, if you find similarities between them, then you can identify at what point does, you know, star formation become sort of a foregone conclusion. If it operates the same here as it does in, you know, a high redshift galaxy, that tells us something interesting about the universe. But if it operates very differently, that's also very interesting. But either way, we really need a local laboratory in the Milky Way, in my particular area of work. That's what we're trying to do, is use the Milky Way that way.
Herschel has had some great successes, but astronomers are a greedy bunch. Despite it having the largest single solid mirror ever launched into space, Mattia isn't quite satisfied.
One of the limitations of Herschel was the resolution, the sharpness of the images, because we normally think that in order to get a sharper image, you just build a bigger telescope. But it's not just about the size, it's also about the region of the electromagnetic spectrum in which you do your observation. So as you move to longer wavelength compared to the optical, which are exactly the wavelength where the Herschel is observing, you lose the sharpness. So even if Herschel has a telescope of 3.5 meter in diameter, a mirror, which is bigger than the mirror of the Hubble Space Telescope, which is instead the 2.4 meter, it turns out that Herschel has had a resolution that is 100 of time worse than the one you have with the Hubble Space Telescope. And so we just see blobs rather than nice-looking galaxies as we are used to with the Hubble Space Telescope. And so how do you overcome this? Well, in principle, you could build a very big telescope, but if you do your calculation, you would need a telescope with a mirror of at least 10 kilometers. And you don't
it's quite
need
hard to launch to space then.
Yeah, but it's also to build on the ground. You don't need to be an astronomer or an engineer to understand that it's not very feasible. And so there is a trick to overcome this that is called interferometry. So basically, you try to mimic a big telescope by building an array of smaller antennas, and you combine their power together to mimic a large telescope. The idea is that of fulfill the area of this hypothetical telescope. So the more antenna you have, the better. And nowadays, we have several of these interferometers located in different places around the world. But in particular, we have one which is extremely powerful, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in the Atacama Desert in Chile, that operates with a battery of more than 60 antennas, providing images at the same wavelength of Herschel that are as sharp as the one you have with the Hubble Space Telescope in the optical, or even sharper than that. And so what have been done after Herschel has delivered this large sample of dust obscure galaxies was that of going and target these blobs and resolve them into what they should look like, okay? So identify their morphology and that
the shape.
That tells you a lot about what is going on in the galaxy, because if the galaxy, the star formation is triggered by the smashing of two galaxies, what we call a major merger, then you would see features like tidal tails, literally bridge of gas between the two initial galaxies that smash together. While instead, if the galaxy is just supported, the star formation, by the constant steady accretion of gas from the galaxy itself, you see a morphology that is more regular. Plus, with ALMA, you can also do the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. You can also do spectroscopy. And so you can that allows you to study how the gas and the dust is moving in the galaxy. And again, that is very important to get information on what is going on, because in a major merger event, you expect to see something that is more messy. You don't expect to see a regular rotation of the gas, which instead what you see in the other case scenario, where you have a steady accretion of gas into the center of the galaxy. So this is what we are currently doing at the moment, not just with ALMA, but also other instruments, of course, around the world, to try and characterize the properties of this blob. And we have hundreds of thousands of them to play with. It's going to take us keep us busy for decades, I would say, to come.
In astronomy, size isn't always king. Matt has another future technological improvement he'd like to see.
You can launch a certain size of telescope into space, but it's very difficult to launch anything as big as the telescopes we can build on the ground. So a bigger telescope would have been better, but also a colder telescope would have been better. So Herschel had a mirror, a main collecting mirror, at a temperature of only 80 degrees above absolute zero. And that's nice and cold by our standards.
It's about minus 200 degrees C or something.
That's
very
right,
cold,
yes, yes. But nevertheless, cold as it was still a little bit warmer than we would have liked. But the technology didn't exist at the time that Herschel was developed to do that. But now we know how to launch a telescope into space and cool the mirror down to only a few degrees above absolute zero, 4 or 5 degrees. And that difference in temperature makes a massive difference to the potential sensitivity of the observatory. The best analogy is that if you imagine observing the stars with a luminous telescope, with a telescope that's actually glowing invisible light, it would be extremely difficult because your own telescope swamps out the radiation you're trying to detect.
Well, it's a bit like looking at a phone screen on a sunny day, I guess. You can't see anything, so you have to go into the shadow.
You're blinded by the background. If a telescope in space can be made so cold that it emits hardly any radiation itself, then it's much easier to see with great sensitivity very faint astronomical objects. So the next generation of infrared observatory will have a much colder telescope, and that will make it far more sensitive than Herschel. It won't have a bigger mirror than Herschel. Solving that problem requires technology in space that isn't quite there yet. So if I look at the future of infrared astronomy in space, I think there are two stages. First of all, get a telescope of roughly the same size as Herschel, but much colder, and we're already working on that with the next generation observatory called Spica. And that will be, believe it or not, thousands of times more sensitive than Herschel.
Just by cooling the mirror.
Just by cooling the mirror, but also equipping the instruments with a new generation of ultra-sensitive detectors that are even better than the Herschel ones. So that's the next stage, and that will be a huge leap forward. And then ultimately, perhaps not in my lifetime, but I hope in the lifetime of some of the listeners, what we call an interferometer, which is a network of telescopes in space covering a large area, which can act as though that large area is itself a big telescope. And that will give us even better image quality combined with sensitivity. There's a huge amount of additional work to be done to exploit the full power of space astronomy in the infrared.
So not just working on the next generation space telescope, but working on the next generation space telescope as well.
That's right. It's always good to look well ahead. As we know, space satellites take a very long time to develop. So it's always good to have a long-term plan, not a detailed plan, but at least a direction in which one is going in order to develop the ideas and develop the necessary technology.
So how is this future technology, such as Spica, going to help Hayley understand supernova dust factories?
Well, I've talked a lot about the amount of dust, the mass of dust, how much each supernova creates. There are two huge problems with me quoting any masses at the moment. One is that most of our supernovae have a huge amount of dust in the vicinity that we don't think is related, and trying to subtract that away is actually really difficult. And to do that properly, you need to have clearer images, you need to be able to see finer structures than we can see with Herschel. So the immediate thing we need is higher resolution, more clarity in our images. Then we can take away all the stuff that we know is not related and get a better idea. The second problem is, and this can change your mass by factor of 100 to 1,000, we have no idea what the dust is made of in these objects. So we can guess it's carbon, we can guess it's silicon rich, but we only have one source that we believe is made of a silica. The dust is made of a silica, so the material like quartz, material we use on Earth all the time in glass and concrete floors. We have no idea what it's made of. And so to do that, we need a next generation telescope where we can look at not only the glow from the dust and see it, so make maps of it, which is what we did with Herschel, but to also check for fingerprints of different atoms and molecules in the supernova to see if it's got lots of iron in, or magnesium, or oxygen, or neon. We have no idea what it's made of. We have to assume that at the moment, and that's one of the biggest challenges we're facing.
That fingerprint, which is the spectrum of the light that tells you about what this stuff is made of, Herschel could do that, but it took it a long time, and so it didn't do that for many objects.
Yeah.
Are there telescopes either online or coming online that can do that?
Yeah, we think that the Spica telescope should be able to do that, and it should be able to do that in a similar way that Herschel did, but as you say, faster, so we can get more data. Sometimes the problem we have, though, is that the part of the spectrum that Herschel could see, where it could see all the dust, actually doesn't have that many fingerprints in it. And that's a real problem. So what we then need to use is other telescopes in different parts of the spectrum. So ALMA can help us here. It can see fingerprints from cold molecules, and we can match that up to where the dust is and say, well, if you see lots of carbon with the ALMA, then it's potentially going to be made up of carbon dust and so on. But Speaker really is the best bet. We should be able to get some really good fingerprints out for a large number of sources and also ones outside our own galaxy. Wow. Speaker will be able to see things at a further distance. So we should be able to see whether the exploding stars in other galaxies have a different makeup.
Herschel has taught us a huge amount about the formation and evolution of stars and galaxies. But there's a lot that it's taught us about, well, us. Here's Matt's thoughts on the political and sociological legacy of the mission.
The most important thing in my mind that we learned from Herschel is that although building a state-of-the-art observatory with a very large international team is extremely challenging and sometimes very painful, and things often go wrong, if you have a group of people who are fully committed to the final result, the final science, then they won't give up. They will solve all the problems on the ground before it's launched, and then one will reap the benefits afterwards. So that the lesson is really that sheer bloody-mindedness and a determination to make it work pays off. One also has to be willing to push the boundaries of the envelope. There were many aspects of technology in Herschel that quite frankly, well, now that the mission has been a success, I can say this, they were a bit dodgy at the time that we started off. So it's a bit like setting the plane going down the runway before you've actually finished building the engines. But sometimes you have to do that, and it did work.
The engines got built before it took off.
That's right. And I think that's actually, although it is quite hair-raising at times, it's a good way to approach technology development, because there's nothing more than a clear project to focus people's attention and indeed to stimulate their ingenuity, their creativity, and their talent.
So what have we learned? Herschel has shown us that dust originates from exploding stars, much of it billions of years ago. It's also allowed us to study the process that takes that dust from interstellar clouds to stringy filaments to protostars. And we know what astronomers would like to see from future telescopes, and how they might learn from the successes of the Herschel Space Observatory. That's it from this special edition of Pythagorean Astronomy. My thanks to Professor Matt Griffin, Professor Hurley Gomez, Dr. Mattia Negrello, and Dr. Sarah Reagan. You can find monthly episodes of Pythagorean Astronomy at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. For now, from me, Chris North, goodbye.